Welcome to Irish Illustrated Insider, brought to you by IrishIllustrated.com. Tim Priest with Pete Sampson and Tim O'Malley. Not a ton happening these days around Notre Dame football, but we'll address a few of those topics. But Pete, you just had an opportunity on Tuesday to sit down with Jack Swarbrick for about an hour. Why don't you give us an update on some of the topics you discussed?
Yeah, there was a bunch of things I wanted to get into. One of them was scheduling, and we talked about the Shamrock Series and how that fit into Notre Dame attempting to make the college football playoff. We talked about sort of the college football playoff rankings and how that sort of is working or not working with the 13th game maybe being a factor. We talked about facilities a little bit. And then Brian Kelly as well. But, I mean, one of the questions that I think a lot of people have wanted to ask Swarbrick since the announcement of moving the Syracuse game to Yankee Stadium in November was just why do that? And, I mean, he admitted that, look, this is not a move that necessarily is 100% good for football. And while he was, I think, not overly defensive about – for a home game, you're going to the hotel mid-afternoon, you're leaving mid-afternoon to a short flight to New York, so on and so forth. I do think that he's sensitive to the fact that this is not probably the ideal way to have November unfold the year after November unfolded with Miami wearing down with Wake Forest there as well, Navy, and obviously the loss at Stanford. So it's... I think with scheduling, and this is a point he tried to make, was just like, I don't think there's ever a perfect schedule. And he even brought up the Georgia series. Like, did he want to play Georgia away next year? No. But if you have to do that to get Georgia at home in 2017, is that worth it? He felt like it was. And on that point, I would agree with him.
Yeah. And, I hear where he's coming from. And if I were in his position, I would say the same thing about, travel and playing the Yankee Stadium and Syracuse and I just don't buy it. I get it. I get that you have many constituencies that you have to serve when you're the athletics director at Notre Dame, and you guys have heard me say this 1,000 times, but he's also the vice president, and that in essence, in itself, puts him in a situation where he has to serve the university first over football. It's still travel. It's still late November. It's still going into the cold and getting home later at night. What's kickoff, 2:30?
Yeah, mid-afternoon kickoff.
Which I think, Pete, you said that, had NBC demanded a night kickoff, then it probably or could have nixed that. But, it all depends upon, first of all, what Notre Dame does at Northwestern a couple weeks prior to that, if they can go there and win on the road. But how it's all going to be perceived will come down to just how much success they have in November and how much success they have away from home.
He knows it makes it a little worse. There's no denying it makes it a little worse. But it's not all about football, right?
Yeah,
that's what it comes down to. It's just not all about the football team. And I think most logical listeners understand that nowadays. You don't have to agree with it. I don't agree with it. I think you could have avoided it. Maybe found a way to. I guess there's many ways to say what game can you turn into the Shamrock Series game. And in a perfect world, as you said, there is no perfect world. You turn the Vanderbilt game into the Shamrock Series, right?
Which I think ultimately was what they wanted to do.
That would have been perfect.
Early in the year. And
no effect on the schedule if you do that. In my minimal effect on the schedule if you do that.
Yeah, unless you played it in Rome. But look, the most disruptive neutral site game that they have played was Navy in Ireland, and they went 12-0 that regular season. Now they came back and almost lost to Purdue the very next week. But so much of this has to do with looking back on it through the prism of, well, how good was Notre Dame, actually? Notre Dame is really good. Playing in Yankee Stadium is not going to make a difference. But I think we've seen too many Notre Dame teams over the last 5 years that have only been pretty good, and the little things do make a difference, and this could be one of those little things.
Yeah, 2012, we've talked about this many times. I mean, the caliber of defense and defensive players and stars that they had on that side of the football – that's what allows you to compensate for things like that. But, I get it. And that's Notre Dame. That's politics. That's what every head coach is going to have to deal with, especially as long as Jack Swarbrick is vice president / director of athletics. That's just the way it is. And Brian Kelly has to accept it because he's complained about it before and nothing changes with regard to that. and the next guy that comes in and replaces him is going to have to deal with it.
You know, another topic we talked about was sort of the indoor facility, because I just thought the way that Notre Dame approached that was odd, in the sense that it was released on a Friday afternoon, which
usually is bad news.
That's called the Friday afternoon news dump for a reason in our industry. It's because if you have bad news you want people not to pay attention to, put it on a Friday afternoon. The indoor facility should have been something that Notre Dame celebrated. So I mined the what the actual facility is a little bit more with Swarbrick, and I guess I was surprised to find out that it literally is just a field. There's not space for nutrition in there. There's not space for recovery. That's not to say those things won't come down the road, built on the back of the Goog or even built over the Goog. There's the construction model for the new facility is engineered so an addition can be put on top of it, literally on top of it, linking the Goog to the facility with some square footage that basically will run over the road. I mean, could they close off that road? Maybe, just sort of fill in that entire space. That's reasonable
so
as well.
Excuse me, Tim, but so they're still going to have to dress in the Goog, go out into the winter of November, cross the street.
To go their indoor facility.
Right.
Yeah, will there be another locker room over there? Maybe. But there's going to be very little in terms of, I think, beyond the field, an observation deck, and a video board in there.
Bare bones football field.
Yeah. Now, I mean, what there will be a lot more height to it. Swarbrick laughed that basically just when we get enough space to practice kickoffs inside, they're doing away with the kickoff. There will be some advantages there where in the past, I mean, they really could not work on a lot of special team stuff inside. Now they'll actually be able to do that. Also, it will not feel like they're practicing in a warehouse from 1972.
Yeah.
There'll be actually some natural light.
This is phase one, basically, of we have to get out of the Loftus Center Mayo Field practice field because it's ridiculous that Notre Dame football still practices in there. With all the advancements they've had on this campus, it was built in 93, the field. It was new to Ron Paulus and those. I mean, think about that. That is no other program of anywhere near this caliber has something like that. Every time we do a practice report, we use the word dank or dark. If we keep seeing it that way, I'm sure it's just not ideal for practicing football.
And I realize, I mean, this is football driven, of course, but you do have, I mean, Notre Dame, especially under Jack Swarbrick, Notre Dame athletics across the board have grown, and so you can't have teams practicing at 5:30 in the morning or 10:30 at night as well, and so this at least loosens things up a little bit for everybody else.
Yeah, and there are NCAA rule changes that prevent those practice times from happening now in a way that was not the case 5 years ago or 10 years ago. So that was fairly interesting. We did sort of talk about the football program at large. I'm curious what you guys think of this theory. I thought that last year's coaching staff was arguably the most cohesive that Brian Kelly has had in 9 years here, and Swarbrick agreed with that. He also felt like this year's staff will build on that and could be better in terms of people pulling in the same direction. Now is it as talented as the staff as last year? Probably not, but he was very high on Jeff Quinn and Clark Lee. We didn't really talk specifically about Terry Joseph, but he felt like the staff overall, and he spoke a lot about Clark Lee. He was very impressed with him as a teacher. He just felt very optimistic that this staff can build on where last year's staff sort of took the program.
It's interesting you mentioned Jeff Quinn, because that's a de facto leadership position. It's not one of Brian Kelly's technical leadership positions, but knowing how much he trusts Quinn, and just the offensive line as being, it's all running through that. Like, Kip Long has to have a relationship with Jeff Quinn, who has a relationship with Brian Kelly all the way across, where Joseph will just prove himself in the end result of how much better were the safeties, did they make plays to help Brian win games. It can't be as talented of a staff because they lost who, just because
it's like
he's gone, doesn't mean he wasn't the best defensive coordinator they could have possibly brought in last year.
It would be like saying the offensive line is better this year than last year.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody would say that because your defensive coordinator is now making $2 million a year, basically, and your offensive line coach is coaching the NFL.
And your defensive coordinator could have been coaching his pupil who's your new defensive coordinator. It wasn't right. like you're losing Clark Lea out of the
I mean, you know, Elko set the path. And I, you know, speaking of Clark Lea, I mean, I don't know anybody that's had any contact with him from fellow coaches to players to media, whoever.
He's great.
I mean, yeah, I mean,
how he still would have been there.
Yeah, I mean, how can you not be impressed with what he's done? So, I mean, and none of that means anything until he's calling defenses in a Michigan game with the game on the line. I get that. But I think, you know, just at this stage, from the outside looking at this stage of the process, I think they're pretty fortunate that they were able to follow Elko with him. Now, the Harry Hiestand, I mean, when you lose Elko and Hiestand, and Pete, you make a good point about the cohesion, and I mean, I don't know how much cohesion you have if Elko leaves a couple days after, you know, one of your biggest wins in,
that's valid.
In a quarter of a century. But
it's made that all worse.
But, no, I mean, the point's still well taken because the players responded to him and the coaching staff responded to Elko. And he's a quality defensive coach. I know a lot of people, like when he left and went to Texas A&M, there's people trying to say, oh, he didn't do that good of a job. Okay. I mean,
the only thing he didn't do well is handle his departure. Other than that, he did a good job.
He didn't do that very well. Although I wrote a story the other day, I think one area where this defense will improve is that, you know, they gave up 4 yards a carry last year. I know that's just a number over the course of 13 games, but I would expect that number to drop. I think they're going to, you know, if you look at, and you look in November, there's a, you know, not even just Navy, but Wake Forest, huge rushing game. I think those numbers will, this year will improve under Clark Lea, mainly because, you know, your front seven is basically coming back intact, and I think that duo in the middle of Coney and Tranquil is going to be outstanding.
You want to talk a little bit about Ball State. We're sort of going to incrementally get through the schedule this summer.
We'll double up on some opponents, but, and I know, you know, it's not exactly bated breath waiting to hear about Ball State.
Well, we almost led with
Ball State. We almost led with.
Priester, summarize Ball State in 60 seconds or less. Go.
You know, they were 2-10 last year. They were terrible. Check this out. In the last 9 games, they gave up 387 points. They gave up 43 points per game in the last 9, scored 12.7. Now, in fairness to them, their quarterback was hurt, Riley Neal. He'll be back. Their running back, who rushed for over 1,300 yards, James Gilbert, also was injured. He'll be back. So they should be a better version. They only lost one, like, real significant player, and that was defensive end Anthony Winbush with an N, and he was a free agent pick of Atlanta. But they've got issues. Their coach is on the hot seat. Their program is not where it was just a few years ago.
12-1 how many years ago?
It's probably more than we think off the top of our head. But
well, was when Brady Hoke was a rising star in the coaching
industry. I guess it was about 9 years
that's
ago.
That's how long ago
right,
it was.
Right. But not a real good team. An excellent team to play the week, whether it's before Michigan or after. In this instance, of course, it's after.
You know, it's this will be a really fun game for Notre Dame fans if they beat Michigan, because it's going to be the best tailgate lot of the year with everyone from Ball State coming up for this game. And if there's high-flying happiness from beating Michigan, this is going to be a little celebration, fun time for Notre Dame with one of the worst teams that has come in here. Who's the worst team you've covered to come in here? Do you think UMass?
UMass would be really high on that list.
They only scored 27 on Van Gorder's defense too. But yeah, they were about
that was a bad that was a bad team. Despite being
they just moved
MAC
up levels.
Contending UMass according to Brian Kelly. I don't know. There have been some bad teams. Like that Western Michigan team had a couple pieces.
They had a pro quarterback.
They had a pretty good. That was Alex Carter. But I think UMass would probably be the worst team that I've seen.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't cover Rutgers, I've got SMU coming off probation.
Oh, baby. Running out of bounds to keep the score down.
Rusty Setzer, yeah.
You know, if you've been on Irish Illustrated a bunch this summer, you've seen that we're doing the Irish Illustrated A to Z series again. I think we have a lot of fun doing those. And it's, to me, there's the most interesting parts to me about those series are looking back at who was ranked where in recruiting. And then also doing player comparisons. And Micah Dutredway, I think, was yesterday or today. So we're just starting into the D's. Of the player comparisons you guys have done or the recruiting rankings, what has been sort of the most like, wait a minute, is that right? I need to actually double check this. Or, oh, I haven't thought about this player in the last 20 years. And now this player on the current team reminds me of this guy.
I want to interrupt you because my favorite part also is, you know, looking back at recruiting and especially player comparison. I love that, going back for Notre Dame history. I am currently working on a kickoff specialist, Jonathan Dorer, who, when you rank kickoff specialists, has to be last, and it's really hard to find a player comparison for a two-year kickoff specialist before taking over field goal duties. So that's my current challenge going on at this point for other than that.
They can be. When Ronnie Rodimer is compared twice within, and that's one thing that we should do a better job of checking to see what the other guy is comparing him to. But
you're blowing my cover. That's Micah Jones. It's not for another few
weeks.
No one's going to read my Micah Jones A to Z.
All right, I had the Freddie Canteen comparison there before the breaking news on Freddie.
You could have had a 3-day weekend, Tim.
I could have, but it didn't happen. But you know, Ronnie Rodimer was injury plagued, even beyond Notre Dame when he left Notre Dame. So that's a comparison. I had Ian Book with Matt LaVecchio. I thought that was a pretty good comparison. Is it a stereotype to compare Aaron Banks to Stewart?
I mean, was he a guard? Is he a tackle? Yeah. I think he even
sheer size too.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's true. Both early enrollees, just sheer size. Those are fun. They can be a challenge. I liked comparing the brash Noah Boykin with Robert Blanton.
That was a good one.
The ones for me that are intriguing are Kevin Austin. Everybody I think that looked at his film thought, wow, he really does remind me when he runs of Michael Floyd. But you can't really compare Kevin Austin to Michael Floyd at this point in their incoming careers. Michael Floyd is the third-ranked wide receiver, with Julio Jones being number one. That was quite a class. It's funny to look at the wide receiver rankings, though, because Austin, I believe, is 82. I should pull that up. I think Austin is 82 in this class composite. Just ahead of Deion Walker at 90 in his class, and a little bit behind Justin Brent at 64.
Yeah.
It's a strange world the wide receivers occupy in the recruiting rankings, because if you just look down at all their... You never get... the bad receiver, the low ranked receiver, become a great player. But boy, are there a lot of great players that don't. In other words, they're not missing on both ends. You need to be ranked somewhere. Like Will Fuller is in, 190. He's a guy that could become a player. And Chase Claypool and stuff like that. You rarely get the lowly rated wide receiver like you do at other positions come up and be a star.
You know, it's Will Fuller is interesting because on ESPN he was the worst guy in the class.
That's a terrible
which is
ranking,
hard to
though.
Believe. You know, a couple of comparisons that I had for guys that I wrote. I went there with Tavon Coney because Manti Te'o is not that far off through three
years.
I think that's
when they're not rookies, you get to do their actual careers.
And then Avery Davis, I struggled with this one because it's like the quarterback who moves positions. But to me, in terms of athletically, it's a little bit. It's more like Abe Elam, where he was a quarterback for a couple days and then was a big time athlete. Obviously his career didn't work out at Notre Dame, but you know, I just think there's some suddenness to his game, whereas I think I couldn't do Holiday or Arnaz Battle because they actually played quarterback at Notre Dame. I had to find somebody who moved before he actually got on the field at that position. But you know, I think I'm not sure which one you guys had Jason Adamolola, but Sheldon Day, I think, is a really good one there. And I think that's one that I think even on signing day, Mike Elston went that far with him too. So it's, you know, you sort of, it gives you a different vibe, to me at least, of, okay, how much talent does Notre Dame have when you're coming away thinking like, oh, this guy kind of reminds me of Joe Brockington or Devin Butler.
Yeah.
That's a little different than Manti Te'o.
Did you have Justin?
I
went Jonathan Bonner with Justin Adamolola because tweener.
Yeah.
Is he an end? Is he going to grow inside? Yeah. Not really sure.
I think Bonner's even more of a tweener than he is. But
well, I jumped ahead with Chase Claypool. He was a difficult one to find, so I tried to project a junior year rise from a guy that has about 400 career receiving yards and about 30 career catches. I think I made a couple people happy, but I'm not sure. I'm not saying he's going to hit this level, but in terms of a junior year rise, I had Jeff Samardzija for Chase.
I thought that was a good one.
Yeah.
Now, he won't have those stats because their name is Brady Quinn.
The thing with this, there's got to be a lot of leeway in order to find some, you know, because, I mean, everybody's different. So you've got to have a lot of rope to be able to compare, and you're not saying he's going to
have 15 touchdowns and 1,200 yards, but I think he's going to have a junior year leap.
Length, athleticism, looks like him too. Ability. Yes. Yeah, I mean,
not facially. He looks like him when he plays football.
There's a lot of comparisons there.
Yeah. So those will continue on through, I think, almost well into
up
July.
To, no, it's into up to August. Up to the day before training camp if it starts on
wrap
time.
Up with Justin Yoon. So you can check all that out on IrishIllustrated.com. So I think that's it for segment one. We've got a bunch of questions for Twitters and our readers next.
Segment two of Irish Illustrated Insider, burning up the boards. We have a question from Patrick N. Florida 1. I prefer Ian Book over Wimbush. Is there any chance for true competition in camp, or will Wimbush be given every opportunity to be the starter regardless of the development production of either quarterback?
I think for Michigan, they've chosen their starting quarterback, barring an off-field incident, which won't happen, or just the worst camp in the history of camps, which also won't happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's with Wimbush, it would have to be, to me at least, a Dane Chris South Florida type of dynamic. That's
still in the Michigan game.
Yeah, but still in the Michigan game, where that it would have to be performance related in a game. I don't know what would have to happen in practice in August for them to make a change, but I don't even think that it's possible to occur. That Wimbush would be that bad.
Wimbush is not going to perform that poorly in practice. I mean, he's proven that he can win the job in practice, so that won't happen. So the three of us are in agreement on that. But I will throw this out. I think this is something that was said in a previous podcast. The difference this year is I don't think that they'll wait and allow Wimbush to lose a game.
No, you know, kind of what Pete said too. They won't. They certainly won't.
Yeah.
They'll go with Book because they know Book can lead them to victory. He's done it as a starter. He's done it in relief, and so that to me that's the biggest difference. Wimbush isn't going to lose a job in the preseason, but he can lose the job in the middle of a game. I don't know that
he lost it in LSU, and
I don't know it would necessarily carry over the next week.
He might have lost. I mean, he lost it basically when it was a little too late in Miami. He lost the job in the game. But Book came in at their interception touchdown. Right. That ruined the whole keep him in there situation.
Right.
So he lost it twice last year in the middle of a game.
Yeah.
And you would not have taken him out of that Georgia game because Book would have just gotten murdered too. There was no reason to take Brandon Wimbush out of
the Miami game was so extreme that you just had to make a change with the quarterbacks.
But we all expect him to start. But I agree with you, Pete and Tim, that bad first half. If it's 10-0 to Michigan and he has a really ineffective first half, I wouldn't be surprised to see Ian Book come out.
Yeah, I guess maybe it would be, if you do the Michigan parallel, Everett Golson against Michigan in 2012. I mean, it's like, Notre Dame won the game, but it took a lot of mucking around for that to happen. And you basically needed a quarterback to do no harm opposed to a guy to go out and make plays. I don't think Notre Dame's going to be in that position against Michigan this year, but that's – something would just have to happen in game. And I think we've got a sort of follow up from Trevor Johnson, Trev Alive, about I think the athletic advantage Wimbush has over Book is overblown because Book is more decisive and makes better reads on zone/read option plays. Agree or disagree?
I disagree, and I want to give a parallel to basketball. Brandon Wimbush's escape from the pocket after a play breaks down, or just a keeper, when he turns into a 50-yard run or a touchdown, is what made that offense last year so unstoppable for a long part of the season. It's like in a basketball game where you can have the five most efficient players playing for Mike Bray, and then all of a sudden you're playing Duke, and there's three future pros like Jason Tatum just get the ball and dunk once in a while. You don't have to work for absolutely everything when you have that athletic advantage, and I think teams that have a guy that is a difference maker, it allows for easy touchdowns that never would happen. It's like allows for easy dunks that never would happen.
I agree with your point there. I agree with the question from the standpoint, like from read option, zone option. Book is great.
I'm not disagreeing with the premise.
He's decisive and explosive out of that, and that aspect is really, really impressive. I think the biggest difference, tying in with what you're saying about turning a real negative into a 45-yard play, Ian Book cannot avoid a pass rush the way Wimbush can. Just not irregardless of turning into a 45-yard run. Just escaping the pass rush. Book just doesn't have that kind of explosiveness moving laterally or having to escape, with a step backwards.
I agree. I mean, the way there's a play against Wake Forest. It was about midfield that turned into, I think, a 50-yard Wimbush touchdown run where spread the entire field out. Wimbush is, I think, ISO'd. You know, it's an empty backfield, and he just takes a step back, and boom, he goes. And you can see the look on Wake Forest's defensive coordinator's face when he's talking to the head coach there, and it's just like, what do you want me to do? I mean, it's not a defensible play. There's nothing Ian Book does that's not defensible.
And he's a running back in the red zone, Wimbush.
Yeah.
He's another weapon. It's going to give him to cover the whole team that way.
And to quote a person within the Goog, Wimbush is Notre Dame's best running back. He is now, certainly with Josh Adams. Yeah. He is their best running back. And you're not going to – yeah, I mean, you're not going to take that kind of athlete off the field.
Speaking of running backs, another Twitter question from Mr. Yips4, last podcast. It was mentioned that the Indy staff was kicking the tires on C.J. Holmes and Deion McIntosh. McIntosh could return but face a 4-game suspension. Any update?
Pete,
tires have been kicked.
Yeah, no, the McIntosh thing, well, you know more about it here.
Yeah,
recently.
I mean, we got some info earlier in the offseason that Notre Dame was really evaluating McIntosh coming back. Well, that's not happening now. He won't be returning. C.J. Holmes, I don't think there's really an update to that either. Neither of them are expected back, and they'll roll with Dexter Williams, Tony Jones, Jafar Armstrong, Jameer Smith, somewhat Avery Davis, and Sebo Flemister after he shows up. That's just how it's going to have to be. They're right at the 86-man number, one to go to get to 85 by the time the season starts. I don't think that they really want to push that too far north anyway. And look, if you can't run an offense with, what, five and a half scholarship running backs, that's a pretty big number for that position. I don't think you need to be at 7.5.
There is optimism as to what Flemister is going to be able to bring to them.
Now, he hasn't
been on field, and so that optimism is easy to have. But there is optimism towards that. And if I would say, if Notre Dame had to choose between which of the two running backs that they could have back, whether it be McIntosh or Holmes, it would be McIntosh.
And I wouldn't bring back a dismissed player that was dismissed for cause. And then to further that, I especially wouldn't bring back that caliber of a dismissed player that was dismissed for cause. It's a different question if it's Michael Floyd. I'm not going to stand on a high horse and say this is how college football should be run. But you know what? Everybody should be treated differently. He was dismissed for cause. He's not good enough to bring back. I wrote about it on Monday, and I believe that an average player, he was not suspended with, let's see if you can go straight.
Yeah, right.
He was dismissed for doing something incredibly stupid.
Yeah, the Brian Kelly definitely cut a much harder line with those guys in December than I expected.
Oh yeah, I did not think he'd be cut from the team, dismissed from the football team, but he has been. So why would you revisit that? You're not bringing back a 1,500-yard rusher that might make a difference in your livelihood, and that the team is going to rally around because you brought back their favorite player. This just it's that players are looked at differently.
Actually, yeah, I totally agree. We had sort of this is a sidebar question to that question from Runway Minister. Looking back through the years at running back, it seems it has been a difficult area all around for Kelly and company in terms of recruiting, eligibility, avoiding trouble, developing, etc. Do you guys have any opinions on this subject? What is the staff doing to improve this issue?
I mean, I can't get over what has happened to the running backs room in the last few years at Notre Dame. We were also making a joke. I was looking just for a Brandon Wimbush stat. This is a tangent. I think he's going to lead the team in rushing touchdowns again. If he plays the whole year, he will. No other quarterback has done that at Notre Dame consecutive years, and you think that I'm going back to like the 40s. I haven't been able to verify in the 40s. You think that seems crazy until you realize Notre Dame always has good running backs. And that is an indictment of Notre Dame's running backs.
It really is. You know, Pete, you can talk about it. I mean, yeah, those are...
The trouble in the room is remarkable.
Yeah, I want to get into it. It's when you think about Autry Denson, the person, the coach,
right,
the way he communicates with them, and the running backs can't stay out of trouble, it's frustrating. It's perplexing, but it's extremely frustrating.
And it's got to be so frustrating for Denson. I mean, I know that it's... I don't know who you're blaming in these situations, but Autry Denson certainly isn't preaching these things the way he lives his life. It's remarkable. Other than being handed a tailor-made human being in Josh Adams, they've had problems in this running back room.
Yeah, I mean, it really doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, look, was Sierre Wood easy to coach? Probably not. You know, like, was Ricky Waters and Tony Brooks easy to coach? Oh, probably not. So I think running backs who are a challenge, Julius Jones had his issues here, suspended for a year. This is not
the irony is Autry Denson was easy to coach.
Yes. It's just irony. Like if it was going to happen to a position coach, it would not happen to Autry Denson. I don't really have a good answer for this question.
It's a great question. That's why
I don't get why Notre Dame hasn't been hitting at a higher level in recruiting at running back. Because, again, who would you want to represent Notre Dame on the recruiting trail better, or who would do it better than Austin Jensen? Very few people, I think. But it just has not clicked for him there.
Yeah, do great running backs look to see, okay, Notre Dame turns out first round draft choices on the offensive line?
Apparently,
I mean,
not.
Obviously, they don't.
they must not. Yeah,
yeah, which makes no sense to me. I mean, I think we all sort of link those two things the same way. We link, well, if you get a good quarterback in, then you're going to get good receivers. I think that sort of has happened, but the offensive line running back link has not.
Do they look? Notre Dame turns out what, a running back?
Well,
because Theo Riddick's like a hidden gem NFL running back that. You know, no one thinks of Theo Riddick really in high school recruiting right now. It's like, well, they had Theo Riddick, and I like that guy.
I hear what you're saying. I mean, there should be, like, shouldn't your offensive line coach help you recruit running backs? I mean, shouldn't there be a cross-pollination of recruiting there?
I agree. It's a question that I don't think any of us have a good answer for, frankly, but it's a good question.
Chino 1047, do they feed you in the press box? And if so, who has the best food?
They do feed us in the press box.
We die. It's an hour day.
We are there for a long... They feed us more than once in the press box.
South Florida, they fed us like six times.
Yeah. So it's usually it's a collection of hot dogs and potato salad at Notre Dame before the game. And then after the game, Papa John's, as far as the eye can see. If you get up there in time, I guess.
Yeah. And we're talking about how many hours? I mean, we're there... 12 to 8, 10.
If the game starts at, if it's a 3:30 game, I think we usually get there around 12:30.
Yeah, yeah, so about 9 to 10 hours.
Yeah. That's two meals.
Yeah, and you can consume a lot of chocolate chip cookies in 9 to 10 hours.
Now, just before we get into who feeds us the best, because that is the most important aspect of this entire podcast, I will say Notre Dame upped its game at halftime last year. They did not just roll out the hot dogs. Remember, there was a theme to every opponent?
Oh, right, yeah.
There was the barbecue for Wake Forest and such. They tried there. They did. They had a theme for every opponent.
They did?
Yeah, they did. you guys didn't go to the right line, I guess. Right, there was always something good out there.
Best places to eat.
Best food. I would two candidates for me. Baltimore is really good because we're at Ravens Stadium. Pretty much any NFL stadium.
That's exactly that's sort what of I one group.
And but I think a surprising upset candidate for best food is Air Force. They brought in like Carrabba's, which I thought was quite good. Now, I didn't have a great appetite for that game. For some reason, I can't quite place it. But I do remember the food. Once I had an appetite around the end of the third quarter, it was good.
We stayed in Denver, right?
In Denver. Everybody blamed the altitude on the feeling we had going.
Totally agree with that. The NFL stadiums.
Oh, Heinz Field was...
Yeah, Pittsburgh's great. Baltimore is great.
AT&T Stadium.
The greatest of all time, of course. Dallas Cowboys. As Pete said when he came back with a cookie, I think there's a grandmother in the back making these.
They were so good.
That was really good. I will throw in Texas a couple years ago. It was very good.
Oh, guacamole.
Yep.
Yeah, that was excellent.
So better than Notre Dame. All right. Sorry.
And this is a question from ND Recruiting 01. Coming from Wisconsin, what is more likely, Graham Mertz or Julius Davis flipping to Notre Dame? If you're not following recruiting, both are Wisconsin commitments today. Graham Mertz, a quarterback. Julius Davis, a running back. Frankly, I like Notre Dame, or I like Wisconsin's evaluations, by and large, at both those positions fairly consistently, especially running backs.
I would say, I mean, Graham Mertz, probably, likely to flip.
My vote would definitely be Graham Mertz. Because, you know, we're talking about why can't Notre Dame get a link between running back recruiting and offensive line recruiting? They definitely have that link happening in Wisconsin, where running backs are like, well, of course, you have these farm-bred offensive linemen here all the time. And I'll just run for 1,500 yards, no problem. But everything I've heard about Graham Mertz and Notre Dame's position there makes me think that Graham Mertz just really wants to play at Notre Dame. That's like a dream for him at the next level. And I give the guy credit if he does that flip, because quarterback is a position with Drew Pine in 2020 and Phil Jurkovec in a couple weeks. It's not a position where there's a lot of just obvious playing time available.
Yeah, those three guys aren't going to stay on the roster together.
No.
No, that link, frustratingly, not to pile on here, works at Stanford clearly too.
Yeah.
I mean, they keep having the national runner-up for the Heisman at running back. They can't do better. They can't get to number one, unfortunately. Yeah. But it's puzzling. That was the best question we've been asked. Why can't Notre Dame link their running backs to offensive line success?
Question from Jason Detweiler. I recently saw a top 25 college football coaches article that snubbed Brian Kelly. Is it unreasonable to expect Notre Dame should always have one of the top 25 coaches in the country? Well, if you took the poll, that poll a couple years ago would have been different. It changes based upon the last year or two.
CBS did a poll, and then Stu Mandel did a poll. And I think I listened to Mandel had a podcast with Bruce Feldman, and Feldman basically said, like, why didn't you have Brian Kelly on there? He's like, he was sort of like right, kind of a 26, 27.
Tell him why. I mean, the stat that I pulled out a couple weeks ago is why.
Yeah, he's 1-12. It is 1-12 in his last 13 against the coaches on this list.
Yeah, not that he hasn't beaten those coaches just once.
The last time they played.
Coached against the other 13 in the top 30.
And it was Mark D'Antonio that he beat.
Correct.
Who was number 16, and boy, he would have been a lot higher 2 years ago.
Is D'Antonio a worse coach now than he was?
The criteria for his, it's strange to me, though, because I realize Lincoln Riley jumped in and went to the playoffs, but... Yes. 1 year, because you're number 15 ahead of Mark D'Antonio and Mark Richt.
Well, that was like Mandel's poll. He didn't have Lincoln Riley on there at all.
I wouldn't think after 1 year you would. Yeah. It's not like he was handed jalopy and turned it into a...
The sake of Notre Dame's schedule, Mandel had Shaw at 8, Harbaugh at 13, Niumatalolo at 17, and Pat Fitzgerald at number 18.
Niumatalolo was not on the list that I referred to.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, everyone can come up with their own list.
And Clay Helton was not in the top 30 on the list that I referred to.
So it's like, you know, is Brian Kelly a top 25 coach? Probably, but he's probably in the 20 to 25 range, right?
I mean, Scott...
Well, you got to count 2 years ago. It's part of it.
Scott Frost is on the list I was referring to.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, I mean...
He probably would be a top 25
but let's see him coach.
And you make that's a good point about Frost, because Fuente is 26, and I feel like Fuente has had two good years at the Power 5 level, and he had a really good resume to get there. So Frost has basically one great year.
I think
Frost went 10-2 last year. He wouldn't be on this list.
Of course, anything like this is so subjective. I mean, Kyle Whittingham's 25th. I mean, who does more with...
For a long time.
Yeah. Who for a long time on a very, very consistent basis. Utah is always right there and a dangerous opponent. How'd you like Notre Dame to play Utah in November in Utah?
Surprised they're not.
Yeah. I mean, it did be. That was one of Kelly's better wins against Kyle Whittingham, Utah at Notre Dame. You know, it's hard to pound the table.
You just illustrated why he might be number 27, by the way.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that.
But it's like compared to...
That wasn't one of his
12 best wins for sure.
Brian Kelly versus Mike Leach or Rocky Long or Gus Malzahn or Dan Mullen. Like, I think that the difference between who's number 16 and who's number 27 is pretty minimal.
Agreed.
I think a better question here was like, shouldn't Notre Dame have more like a coach that is viewed as top 10 nationally at all times? Ideally, yes, but right now, make that argument.
Yeah,
today.
Then you'd be changing coaches as soon as somebody had a bad year.
Fair too.
I mean, the bottom line is, in 8 seasons, should Brian Kelly only have 3 double digit winning seasons? No, it should be better than that in Notre Dame.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the reason the season is so interesting.
CMU Pens fan, if you had to rank this year's road game trips you have to make, how would you rank them from most looking forward to all the way to, boy, is this going to suck?
One, Navy in San Diego.
Concur.
Two, Virginia Tech. Three, Los Angeles, USC, 4 Northwestern, 5 Syracuse, Yankee Stadium, and 6 Wake Forest, which is in Winston-Salem.
Yes, it is. Navy won, and it's not even close. It's been that way for 4.5 years, 5 years since it was announced. Virginia Tech is a bucket list stadium to visit for any college football fan. I assume that game will be at night and very loud. When you have LA third on the list, that's a good season.
Yep.
Mine's a little different from Pete here. I'll explain why. Syracuse, because I said I have a going to have a stake at Keene's. I'm looking forward to that trip. I'd like to thank the Notre Dame administration for moving the home game out of November. Tim and I are the only two that feel that way. Wake Forest is ahead of Northwestern for me because I will be driving into Chicago the day of the game and driving back that night, and that is not.
That's a negative, you're saying.
That's a massive negative for me, yes.
Well, you know, the top three, I think, are, I mean, San Diego, great location. Virginia Tech, I've been talking about for years about, you know, having the opportunity to go there for a night game. L.A.,
is always
where
fun.
We stay, yeah. It's always great. You know, Northwestern, Syracuse, Wake, you can probably put them in any. It's always great to go to North Carolina. Of course, there'll be a hurricane that weekend. There's no doubt about it. Although that's late September.
Yeah, I think we're beating North Carolina, NC State weekends, Clemson type weekends there. So it's
all of them.
It's amazing. Wake Forest is upgraded by the easy to get there from here, where it's actually direct flight from South Bend into North Carolina now. San Diego, the city, Virginia Tech, the venue. Those are 1 and 1A for me.
The playoff game at stake for LA also. So you have to throw a plug in there for the positive.
Yeah, that's fine too.
Northwestern is also the game where
none of us like that game right now.
Let's see what kind of year.
Well, does it really matter what kind of year Northwestern's having? That, yeah. Well, we'll do. There'll be plenty.
Different
of time.
Question.
There'll be plenty of time for trepidation regarding that game. Old Mullen, how much of an impact should recruiting success have on whether a coach is retained? Follow up. What will happen if Notre Dame goes 8-5 this year?
We talked about this right before the segment. It's the recruiting impact when it's very low or very high is obvious. It's more of a gray area where, like, the tiebreaker for Tyron Willingham was he had 2 offensive linemen brought in 3 years. It wasn't like, what direction is this going? Now, Charlie Weiss had good recruiting going when he was fired, so that did not bring him over the top, if you want to look at it that way. He had 3 really good years in a row, and he had just brought in what has proven to be Brian Kelly's best class in terms of top heaviness, the Manti Te'o freshman class.
Well, I think you could argue that maybe it did make sure that he was not fired before 2009. I think that if his recruiting was like Willingham's, he would not have had a 5th year.
Yeah, because that's a good point, because his 4th year wasn't great.
Yeah,
bounce back.
It was quite bad.
The third year
wasn't not great.
Well, the third year was always going to be
bad. You can say a lot of things about Weiss,
bad,
but he worked his ass off in recruiting.
No question.
He didn't necessarily direct it in the right way, but you know, he didn't necessarily tend to his roster for balance the way he needed to, but he worked really, really hard at it. Tyrone did not.
There's a related follow-up that's kind of difficult because I think semantics go into this. What will happen on this topic if Notre Dame is 8-5 this year?
People will be upset.
Yes,
that's what will happen.
And I think the type of 8-5, if there's a bad...
Especially if it's in November.
If it's November, end of October, November.
How else would you get to 8-5? Because if you're saying...
You could lose to
Black. What, to Vanderbilt?
No, but you could lose to Stanford, Michigan, and Virginia Tech. That'd be terrible, too. But you could lose to them all, right?
If you lost every game of consequence?
That'd be bad, but you could lose those games, though.
It would be quite bad.
Yeah, I think they're, barring a rash of injuries on defense, I think their defense is too good to...
I don't think that will happen. I'm saying those teams, that 3 of their 6 peers are in the first half. But I think people will remember if you have another bad November.
Yeah, and this goes back to Brian Kelly top 25. Don't lose 4 and 5 games on a regular basis and you'll be in that top 25.
I don't think that a collapse would be viewed any better or worse than losing to Michigan and Stanford.
Because there's no
hope. Virginia Tech and Florida State and USC. If you lost every marquee game of consequence,
there's no hope along the way either.
Right. Yeah. That would get into what are we doing here? Aspect. If you can't beat a good team,
so 5 losses is 5
losses.
Five losses is 5 losses.
Yeah,
yeah.
It just there's no way to get to, especially with this. This is actually, I think, for my money at least, this is a good schedule. Like a schedule Notre Dame can work with. to get to five losses in the regular season.
Okay, so that's a good tie into our next question, which is from Autone. True or false, if Notre Dame finishes 11-1 with a close loss to Michigan, Notre Dame is more likely than not to make the playoffs?
Yeah, 11-1 with a close loss in the opener.
Yes, true.
True.
Yeah, for sure, and that's why I think people get too caught up in, you know, the 12 game. You talked to Swarbrick about that, 12 games as opposed to 13. That wouldn't have been, you know, with the Georgia loss last year, Notre Dame clearly would have been in the playoffs had they been able to have success in
November. Oh, yeah, they were poised to be.
Well, they were third.
They were third when they showed up in Miami. Right. So, yeah, it's like, that's, you know, I don't like the term must win. It's too easy to use, and it doesn't really mean anything because, like, it's a must win or what? Like, until you get the or what? Like,
it's just the fan base must win of last year's Georgia. Where,
right.
But they don't, actually, Notre Dame, to Tim's credit, when he said they are going to be, what it would be, 4-1 or 5-1 for the USC game after losing to Georgia, they at least had some teams to get the fans excited. Notre Dame has nothing until Stanford. If they lose the Michigan game, that's the problem.
It's a must win if you want to go undefeated. It's also a must win if you want the month of September to be exciting at Notre Dame. Those are the two things where, yes, absolutely is a must win or else A or else B.
And it's hard to go, if they lose to Michigan in a close game and both teams look great, just like the Georgia game, or both teams look formidable, just like the Georgia game, it's just hard to run this whole thing with 11 straight wins. You would figure they would lose another game.
Yeah, I just think that if you lose Michigan, you're going to lose again.
Right. Yeah, the problem with losing to Michigan is that you weren't good enough to beat Michigan. Right. That means you're probably not going to be good enough to beat 11 other teams. Exactly.
Wash ND, which player is more important? In other words, which can they not afford to lose to have success this season? Center Sam Mustipher or linebacker Tavon Coney?
They were my 2 and 3. So I guess Coney, because he was my 2. Tillery was my number 1, because I think it would break down the defense. A nose tackle that allows my Tillery idea is that having Tillery allows the players around him that are younger and up and coming to play their right role. Where if you have Heinisch or Tagovailoa-Mosa starting and moving up in that role, that's not a championship contending team. So that's why Tillery's trickle down effect is one for me. Coney's right there because he's their best player. And then Mustipher's at the most important position where they don't have a backup because Ruin keeps getting hurt and hasn't played. You don't know he'll be a good backup just because they like him.
I think a lot of people look at this question and be like, well, obviously it's Tavon Coney. Didn't you watch the Citrus Bowl? I would say it's way closer than that between these two. And I think also, if you look at Notre Dame's leadership group this year, to me it's Sam Mustipher. And I don't want to like denigrate Drew Tranquil or Alex Barnes or Tyler Newsome. But I do think Sam Mustipher is as close to a Quentin Nelson, Mike McGlinchey as there is in that group. I mean, I think Tranquil is a good leader.
Yeah.
But I think in terms of a guy who's going to make sure that Notre Dame's offensive line has its crap together at all times, that is really, really important this year, I think Sam Mustipher delivers.
I think that's a kind of a DNA thing, you know, with offensive linemen / Harry Heastand coach offensive linemen, whether that will continue with Jeff Quinn or not, I don't know. You know, at least with Ruland, it's a guy that they
like him.
They like him, and if he could stay healthy, I mean, I certainly think he would be functional at that position. Jonathan Jones would be functional, I guess, but Coney's a superstar now. I mean, he is potentially a superstar here in this upcoming season. So
do you disagree with the Jerry Tillery idea notion?
I do, from the standpoint that I think MTA / Jason Adamolola could probably give you some pretty quality and consistent production.
My thought is they can do that with Tillery, too. And you could have a defensive line where you finally have...
Well, true, and then Adamolola probably doesn't always play nearly as much, which is a true freshman, so that's probably good. But
yeah, I mean, if you wanted to get... And this is probably a good way to get into insane ND Tucson. Which of the incoming defensive freshmen do you think could make a surprise impact other than the ones expected to be in the 2-deep? I think Jason Adamolola, I think it's safe to say he'll be better than Heinisch or Tagovailoa-Mosa were last year. If that's the case, and you have him helping at least one of those guys, almost certainly MTA.
It helps them all, though. I mean, it's just having all that bodies in there.
There's no reason MTA can't take some snaps from Heinisch as well. If those are your three backups at those positions, behind Bonner and Tillery. That's a pretty good group. And
you think they'll cross over like that at three technique and nose tackle?
I'm just saying MTA could do it. You know, could he help at multiple positions? I think probably so. I don't think Adam Alola can do it, nor do I think Heinisch can do it. Not that Heinisch couldn't learn it. I just think he's built to be a nose.
I think he's built.
I agree with that. Adam Alola, there's some flexibility there, I think, but not Heinisch.
No. So it's like if those are your three first guys off the bench, then
that's what I'm like
with Tillery and Bonner. That's a nice five man group to me.
Well, we all want to see Tillery, who should be at his peak, playing his best position in his final year of eligibility, playing for a shot to have a spot in the NFL. Let's hope it doesn't come down to that, because it's potentially a really exciting year for him. Last question from...
Yeah, that was sort of bridging into the last question. Other defensive freshmen you think can make an impact? We talked about Jason Adamalola in the context of that last question.
We all assume Derek Allen and Houston Griffith will. Or we assume Houston Griffith will, and I believe Derek Allen will make an impact. As the season progresses, as the season goes along.
Yeah, I really wasn't looking at guys that were here in the spring. I looked at incoming defensive, I looked at those guys as
well. I mean, everybody likes Shane Simon, but there's a glut of players right now at Rover. It's not like he's going to walk in and take over the number two job. He's got Owusu Koromoa, who everybody likes. He's got a starting senior, him, Bilal.
Right.
That's
right.
He'll play too because of special teams. He's a tailor made.
I think I'm most interested. If you're looking for, the deep cut here, what happens with the four corners who come
totally
in?
Agree. Yeah. Totally agree.
Because I just, if you said, you just pulled one of those names from a hat and said, this is going to be the best guy in this class and he's going to help Notre Dame this year, I could not argue for or against any of them. None of that would surprise me. I think maybe the most likely is none of them really do anything this year. But over the course of their career, who's going to be the best of those four? I absolutely have no idea. I think they all have different assets that could help Notre Dame.
The corners,
you put them in order, one through four of the corners.
Well, the corners, the part of the corners interesting is who starts out and sticks at a boundary corner, because that's an open spot.
Look, Dante Vaughn doesn't fit there.
Right. But at field corner, they moved Dante Vaughn because they did not like how he fit at boundary corner. Now he has to move back to boundary corner because they lost Nick Watkins. And they explained it about Vaughn in kind of an understanding of football situation, which going into your junior year, that's not a good thing, that the field is that much more obvious to you than the boundary. That means you're missing some of the technicalities of the game. The Dante Vaughn fall from grace, if it's not just athletic injuries taking a toll and making him look worse. He was fine as a true freshman out there when they threw him in, right? I mean, he came out and played
fine. He was,
fine.
But they were in transition with coordinator, and they're just looking for a guy to make
plays.
But
he didn't look lost.
But I think I think his length and just his flat ability to make plays on the football, that didn't mean that he knew.
Right.
I know what you're saying. He didn't look lost. He was around the football, and he made plays. But then you bring a guy like Elko in, and Elko didn't have any intention of playing him.
True.
So that tells you that he didn't have a real good grasp of what they were trying to run out there.
So if he can be beaten out on the boundary, then it's whoever goes to boundary, which we talked to Todd Light in the spring. This was early spring, but he's a great interview for these things. He actually offered that Boykin would start on the boundary, Bracey would start to the field, and Wilkins would start at both.
Yeah,
in other words, DJ
Brown
to the boundary.
To the boundary.
So one of those guys can be second string if you beat out Dante Vaughn, who's been hurt a lot.
And the most talented guy there is Boykin.
Yes.
Okay. Now will he be more coachable than Wilkins? And
right.
I know people don't like to keep hearing that, but that's an ever-present thought in the minds of everybody around Notre Dame.
Yeah, and I talked to his defensive coordinator, Noah Boykin's defensive coordinator, for about 45 minutes on a bunch of things, and that was one of them. And look, Noah Boykin has supreme confidence, whether it is justified or not, in his own ability, where he came up to the varsity as a freshman and basically said to the coaches, why aren't you putting me on their best receiver? Why am I even here? What am I doing here? One of the other corners on that team is starting at Oklahoma, who is older than Noah Boykin. Wow. So it's not like he hasn't played with talented guys. He thinks he is the best guy on the field at all times. That's great. if you channel it the right way.
Yeah.
It's going
to
be...
that's a hard transition to this level of, you know.
I'm so interested to see how he slots into the roster and the culture of the program. Because Notre Dame just doesn't sign a lot of guys who just thinks, like, screw it, I'm the best guy out there. If you're not going to play me on the guy, why am I even here? Why do I need to show up to practice?
And thus my comparison to Robert Blanton, who was very similar to that. I love Tariq Bracey. I think long-term he's going to be very good. I don't think physically he's going to be anywhere near where he needs to be this fall. These are the guys that I wrote. Well, I wrote down Derek Allen, Shane Simon, but those are guys that could slot second team.
Right.
The two that I wrote down were Noah Boykin and Joe Wilkins. I love Joe Wilkins' size.
And Light seems like Wilkins' approach to the offseason and to coming in being best prepared. He said that Wilkins is the guy that's constantly contacting him, saying, what can I do? Yeah. What can I learn?
That's important.
That is important when you're starting out.
Yeah.
Are we missing anybody else? I mean, Jamie and Franklin.
Last year he would have, maybe.
I don't know how he's going to move ahead of Bonner and Hynish unless there's an injury there.
And that's a situation to me, at least. Like, is he going to be better than fourth-year senior Micah Dutredway?
He should not be.
It's bad news if he is.
Right.
Maybe it's good news for Jamie and Franklin if he is. But that he would have to be so clearly better than a guy who's been in a college football program for 4 years to make playing him even make sense.
I feel like Dude Treadway can be functional this year, don't you? If he just stays healthy.
I do. I gave him pretty much a scathing review coming out of high school. But the one thing I said was, this is a long, big, athletic dude. He has no idea what he's doing out there. And he may never know what he's doing out there on the collegiate level, but you're starting to see some of that, and now he's really big. I agree with you. You know, how many snaps are we talking about? 10, 12?
I wasn't going as 10.
Right. But less than that.
That'd be great. Though,
about, like, over the course of the season, you're talking about a 5-snap player.
So one series.
But really, that's an average of 5 snaps, where half of his total snaps are going to come against Ball State.
Yeah, true.
So you're just really in snaps of consequence, you're probably talking about 15 snaps all year.
Yeah.
It's not a lot. So it's, you know, I don't
want more than 15 all year, I think.
Yeah.
Would be the way to say it. Oh, sure. No, maybe not. Of consequence, right, where it's a major part of the game. Yeah, that's good.
All right, so one real quickly, who's the guy on offense that fits this
scenario? The guy that could contribute this year that is
awesome.
Probably Lawrence Keys, I guess. I don't really know who else would qualify. I think Lindsey and Austin are too renowned.
they're too renowned.
It's like, I really like this Kyle Rudolph guy.
They expect both of them to play. I think the big concern with Lawrence Keys is, will he have the upper body strength to compete at this level as a freshman? Because lower body, I mean, speed and maneuverability and all that, he's got it. But can he take the pounding as a freshman who isn't quite
gadget player to me?
Right.
That's what he can be this year.
Flemister is too obvious now.
Flemister's
That was mine before we were thinking Notre Dame wouldn't have their whole running back roster.
And we can't conclude a podcast without me just saying Jafar Armstrong. It has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but we haven't mentioned him yet.
So Alize Mack. Okay, there we go. Got it.
Yeah, there's... It's interesting. I was doing a story on Derek Allen and his off-season training, and he works with a guy who played at Valdosta State in the CFL named Cedric Dickerson, and he said, like, what these freshmen don't get is that really by the end of that first week, maybe halfway through that first week, the coaches have already decided whether you can play or not.
So the first week?
The first week of training camp, they're like, this guy can help us this year. We'll see you next year. I think for these freshmen coming in, there's these potential contributors. Brian Kelly might not tell us by the end of that first week, but the coaches will know. Lawrence Keys, yes or no. Wilkins, yes or no.
Think about Darnell Yule.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, that first day of call for him was done.
Yes or no.
It's the first drill.
that stuff happens a lot quicker than I think people think.
Actually, Audrey Denson did say that they knew Josh Adams was going to help them the first practice of Culver of his first ever practice.
Yeah. Having been in coaching on a lower level, that's absolutely true. Your first impression, you can't change your first impression. It is what it is, good or bad.
Yeah, so it'll be fascinating to see that training camp, thankfully still 2 months away. So we will be back, Irish Illustrated Insider, probably in the next couple weeks, talk a little bit more about the schedule, get into Vanderbilt, get into the rest of September as well. So until then, Pete Sampson, Tim Priester, Tim O'Malley, thanks for listening.